will not be another foot of wall constructed in my administration, number one. Number two, what I'm going to focus on, and the fact is that somebody in this group written a lot about the border. I'm going to make sure that we have border protection, but it's going to be based on making sure that we use high-tech capacity to deal with it.
Joe Biden, during an interview with journalists of color back in August, and Biden appears to be holding true to his promise. On his first day in office, he signed an executive order halting construction of the wall. He also sent an immigration bill to Congress. It would put the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants on a path to citizenship. We're going to talk about that now with Laura Barrón-López, White House correspondent for Politico. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first talk about the executive orders Biden issued on this. First, what did he do regarding Dreamers, DACA recipients, the people brought here as kids who aren't citizens?
Yeah, so he directed the Department of Homeland Security to pretty much fortify and shore up protections for Dreamers. So exactly how long those protections are going to last is a question, but they're going to have protections for the foreseeable future to remain in the United States.
And then would they be put on a speedier path to citizenship?
Yeah, that's right. So assuming that an immigration bill passes. So as Biden and the new White House has made clear, they sent an immigration bill, a comprehensive one, to Congress first day of his administration, which was yesterday. And they're trying to get the ball rolling on working with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. They've been having multiple conversations with House members and senators on immigration, Democratic senators and House members, in the lead up to him taking office. And so, but the big question is, given the slim majority in the House and given the 50-50 Senate, whether or not there is enough ability or political will to get it across the aisle. But the bill that he sent them would give Dreamers an expedited route. It would give Dreamers an expedited route, TPS recipients, and farm workers. Those three, the people that meet those three criteria would be able to immediately get a green card, and then they would only wait another 3 years before applying for naturalization.
And then for everyone else, that would also be a faster process.
Technically, yes, because in the Gang of Eight bill that was proposed in the Obama era, it would have been 13-year wait time. And so now the Biden administration is proposing an 8-year wait time for everyone else that didn't qualify in those three other categories I mentioned. So essential workers that aren't farm workers, all other undocumented that make up the 11 million that are here, they would, after a 5-year temporary status, be able to apply for a green card, and then they'd have to wait another 3 years before they can apply for citizenship.
And so far, what is the appetite on the part of Republicans for even discussing this?
Yeah, right now, the most immediate reactions don't seem to be the best from Republicans. Even Republicans that in 2013 would have totally been on board with really trying to find a pathway with Biden for Dreamers and for other undocumented immigrants. But there's been statements already from Senator Marco Rubio of Florida and Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, too, that worked in the Obama years to try to find a way for comprehensive reform. And they're already saying that the type of bill that Biden's sent to Congress isn't something that they necessarily would get behind. They think that it should just be a clean Dreamer bill, one that just focuses on Dreamers. And that's not something Democrats want at all. A lot of Democrats want to see big reform finally pushed through Congress.
Meanwhile, some other executive orders, a moratorium on deportations right now, but just a temporary one. Why?
Right. So what the new administration is saying is, during the campaign, Biden promised to put a 100-day moratorium. They followed through with that later yesterday evening. They instituted it. The reason they say it's temporary is because it's simply to get a handle on everything that was done to the immigration system the separation of children, the backlog of processing at the border for immigrants seeking asylum. It's for them to get a handle on what exactly was done in the prior administration. And so they're not saying that they would have that moratorium on deportations indefinitely once they figure out exactly how the system is working.
Hmm. And what about all of those asylum seekers, thousands, tens of thousands of them, who were sent back across the border in Mexico and are waiting to hear about their claims? What's going to happen to them?
Well, right now, the administration is pretty much telling asylum seekers and immigrants to kind of stay where they are. So they're putting a restriction on travel because of the pandemic. And so they're going to keep some of those restrictions in place because of how bad the pandemic is at this stage. So that's kind of where things are at right now. But more and more is emerging, you know, as the administration is taking over and figuring out the state of the immigration system.
And so is all of this encouraging more migrants? Are people south of the border, and not just in Mexico, but in other in Central American countries, are they thinking, oh, well, now is a good time to start making my way north?
Well, I can't really speak to that, but what I do know is that the administration is trying to address those root causes that you're talking about, which is they're trying to also, with the bill that they introduced, talk about assistance to the Northern Triangle countries. So we're talking about El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and what can be done to prevent more migrants coming over the coming months and over the years ahead.
And finally, what about the wall? So he called for an immediate halt to construction. What does that mean? Does that mean there's going to be a half-built wall there, or is he going to dismantle it? What?
Well, I don't know if he's going to dismantle it. I think that the administration is probably going to leave what reinforced fencing was applied. Whether or not they continue on, it appears as though the indication is that they may not, because of the fact that they're stopping all that construction and they don't want the money to be going to that anymore.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us and updating us on the plans.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Laura Barón López, White House correspondent for Politico. Well, in addition to immigration reform, President Biden has a lot of other big plans dealing with COVID, healthcare, climate change, etc. But there is a massive hurdle in the way of all of that, and that is the Senate filibuster. That's the rule that requires 60 votes to end debate on a bill before it can actually be voted on. The filibuster has been used by both parties when they're in the minority to kill legislation. And it really is the main reason why Congress doesn't seem to accomplish much these days. So how did we get here? And is it possible or even desirable to get rid of the filibuster? We're going to ask Molly Reynolds that. She's a senior fellow at Brookings and an expert on the filibuster. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Well, we already see the filibuster or the threat of it in action right now, or at least wrangling over it with Senate minority leader, I guess that's his new position, Mitch McConnell, saying he wants to hold up switching committee chairships to the Democrats while asking Chuck Schumer, the Democratic majority leader, to promise not to kill the filibuster. So can you describe exactly what's happening today?
Sure. So every time the Senate starts anew at the beginning of a new Congress, the Senate adopts what we call an organizing resolution, which importantly sets the ratios for committees, decides how many Democrats and Republicans will be on those committees, does some other kind of procedural organizational things. That resolution, right now, the Senate is a little bit tied in knots over because, as you said, Mitch McConnell is asking Chuck Schumer to promise not to ban legislative filibusters. McConnell is saying that Republicans will obstruct that very basic organizing resolution until Schumer makes this promise. We'll have to see kind of how this ultimately gets resolved. But it is, as we start to think about the future of the filibuster in the current Congress, it's a pretty strong signal from McConnell that Republicans are willing to obstruct and are willing to make it more difficult for Democrats in United Party control of Washington to get things done.
So already we're seeing a gumming up of the process. Does Chuck Schumer want to get rid of the filibuster?
So Schumer himself has said a number of different things on this over time. He's under, I think, a fair amount of pressure from both some of the members of his own party in the Senate and certainly from lots of folks outside of the Senate to eliminate the filibuster because, as you mentioned, it really is preventing some things that Democrats want to do with their new unified control of Washington, some things that they really want to get done.
Right. And so let's explain exactly how we got to where we are now, because as I said in the intro, we're at a point where the filibuster is used pretty much to kill legislation. It was never intended to do that. And it wasn't even in the Constitution. So why do we have a filibuster in the first place?
Yeah, so the filibuster is a little bit of an accident of American history. So it, as you said, it's not in the Constitution. And to understand how we got it, we have to go back to the early 19th century, to 1805. Aaron Burr is vice president, and he's presiding over the Senate. And he basically kind of takes a look at the rule book that the Senate has and says, there's a lot of stuff in here that the Senate's not currently using. It's you have rules that do the same thing. You're not using all of them. One of the rules that you have that you're not using is something called the previous question motion, which allows a simple majority in a chamber, in this case, the Senate, to cut off debate, again, with just a simple majority. The Senate wasn't using the previous question motion in 1805. So Aaron Burr recommends they delete it from the rule book. The Senate goes along with this, takes it out in 1806. Once it's gone, there's not an immediate kind of explosion of filibusters, but it does make possible the possibility of extended debate. Over the course of the rest of the 19th century, we don't see a whole lot of obstruction in the Senate. But then by kind of the middle of the 19th century and moving forward, we see much more effort by the minority to obstruct what the majority wants to do.
Especially when it comes to issues revolving around slavery, right?
Certainly revolving around slavery and civil rights. And then this continues in into the 20th century as well.
Again, involving civil rights.
Yes.
So the filibuster, though, it seems to be used now on steroids. In the last, I don't know, several administrations, it seems that this is the primary way for the minority party to stymie the legislative priorities of, you know, the president in power and the party in power. And so how did it become such an overused option?
Sure. So I think the kind of what we see as the modern use of the filibuster today, the roots of that are really in kind of the mid-1970s when a couple of things happen. One, individual senators start to be under more and more pressure from groups and actors outside of the chamber to use all of their procedural rights to try to make things happen or not happen in the Senate. So you have that. And then beginning in the late 1970s, early 1980s, we have the start of the really significant political polarization that we observe in American politics happening. And so as the parties become more polarized, each party has more and more of an incentive to prevent the other party from trying to get things done. You really, if you're in the minority, you don't want to cooperate with the majority. And if you're in the majority, you really don't want to cooperate with the minority. So all of these conditions together have helped produce the routinization of the filibuster that we see today.
Well, now, as we've discussed, there is an appetite on the part of Democrats to get rid of it now that Democrats are in power in all three chambers. And so I'm wondering, though, if they're thinking, well, gee, we might not always be in power. And it was pretty useful to for example, stymie some of President Trump's priorities when they were in the minority in the Senate. And so are some Democrats thinking, you know, maybe we should hang on to this?
So it is a real question. I think that we are seeing more and more Democratic actors, both inside the chamber and outside the chamber, push the Democrats to eliminate the filibuster because they do see it as really the obstacle for accomplishing a lot of progressive policy goals. But that prospect of losing control of the Senate in the future, a future period of unified Republican control, and the number of things that Republicans could try and do once the filibuster is eliminated. There's this difference between kind of the issue on which the dam actually breaks and a party decides to get rid of the filibuster with what are all those things that are pent up behind the dam that might flow through more easily once the filibuster is gone. And so kind of balancing those considerations, I think, are what Democrats are going through right now.
So given all of this, do you expect that Biden would be able to get through his ambitious policy agenda with the rules as they are? Or does there need to be a significant change in the way the Senate operates?
So it depends a little bit on which issues we're talking about. Obviously, there are things that Biden would like to do that can be done through executive action and don't require acts of Congress. But for some of the things that he's talked about, it really would require overcoming the threat of a filibuster in the Senate. So it will either be a matter of getting Republicans to cooperate or getting Democrats to decide the issue is sufficiently important and they are in sufficient agreement to go ahead and change the rules of the Senate in order to get things done.
Molly Reynolds, senior fellow at Brookings and an expert on the filibuster. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
President Biden called for unity yesterday, and yesterday right-wing media pretty much rejected that. We'll talk about what the post-Trump mediascape looks like next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Presidential inaugurations are typically celebratory affairs. Yesterday was no exception. There was, of course, the pomp and the circumstance, praise for President Biden's call for unity. But if you watched conservative media last night, especially Fox News, it felt like a different world.
Team Biden turns against America.
A truly unremarkable, totally forgettable, even pre-rehearsed set of remarks.
Now that we're waging war on white supremacists.
So to falsely frame half the country as racist, I don't feel like jives with his unity message.
About unity, and we all must join the ranks of rampant butt kissers.
All right. So what is the future of the media magosphere now that its number one viewer, Donald Trump, is no longer in office? We're going to ask Matt Gaertz. He's senior fellow at the left-leaning watchdog group Media Matters, where he has spent the past half decade focusing on Fox News and its relationship with Trump. Welcome to Press Play, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in that montage, we heard from Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Tucker Carlson, among others. What did Fox News look like yesterday? And was there a split between the daytime, more newsy side and the nighttime commentator side?
Yes, there was a bit of one. In general, Fox was trying to help its audience cope with the reality that Donald Trump is not president anymore. They spent weeks and months since the election trying to forestall needing to tell them that, suggesting that the election had been stolen, suggesting that Trump had some way to eventually become president. But that has clearly not worked out for them. Joe Biden was sworn in yesterday. And so they are trying to help their audience cope. And the way that they are doing that is by reminding them about all the various grievances that they have against Joe Biden, against the media, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, in the initial reporting coming out of Joe Biden's speech, you did have Chris Wallace praising it. Chris Wallace is the host of their Sunday show. He said it was the best inaugural address he's ever seen. But as the afternoon went on, you would get more and more criticism, especially as the pundits there started fixating on the idea that Joe Biden's criticism of white nationalists and white supremacists and violent extremists was actually about them and their audience.
Right.
And by the evening, you had the sort of full-throated attack on the incoming Biden administration that you just played.
Yeah. Well, let's hear from Tucker Carlson talking about what you just mentioned.
They denounce you, your critics, their critics, as white supremacists, and then they just ignore what you said. Fine. We've dealt with this for years. We're used to it. It no longer hurts our feelings. We understand what's going on. But there's a new regime in power starting today, and they seem to be planning to accelerate things dramatically. They're getting the FBI and the Pentagon involved in this hunt for people who may criticize them.
What is he talking about there?
So he is conflating a very specific move by the incoming Biden administration to go after white supremacists, domestic terrorists, the people involved in the insurrection at the Capitol earlier this month, five people died as pro-Trump rioters stormed the sanctuary of democracy. They're conflating that with the entire right-wing movement, with every person who voted with Donald Trump, with everyone who watches Fox's programming. It's a very cynical move, I think, and one that is intended to keep their audience angry, afraid about the future, and watching the network.
Right, because more of the really right-wing viewers are going to other places like Newsmax and OAN because, you know, Trump himself has criticized Fox News for not being sufficiently right wing. So are they trying to protect their ratings and protect their audience?
That's exactly right. It's basically an attempt to win back some of the viewers from their right flank that have either stopped watching cable news altogether since Trump's defeat or listened to President Trump and took their viewing to OAN, the One America News Network, or Newsmax TV. And so I think this is a dynamic that we're going to,
Well, I guess I'm wondering, because there was such a symbiotic relationship between Fox and President Trump, what does Fox do now? Does it still hold up the Trumpism and talk about Trump as the leader of the party, even though he's, you know, out in the wilderness in Florida somewhere? Or do they find someone else? How do they adjust to Trump not being there?
Well, I think they have two options. I mean, they could sort of side with their news side, the people like Chris Wallace, who try to keep the network's coverage at least somewhat tethered to reality. Or they can side with their opinion side, the right-wing propagandists and demagogues like Carlson and Hannity and Ingraham, who built those close ties to Trump and his administration over the last 4 years. I think it's pretty clear from actions the network has taken that they're going to go down that second path. They've already cut an hour of the putative news coverage and replaced it with another hour of right-wing talk. They have laid off a series of their digital reporters, including their political editor, who headed up their decision desk that angered Trump in the first place by saying that he had lost Arizona and then the election. So they do not seem to be moving on quite yet. They do seem to want to continue to stick with Trump because that's where they think the viewers are. And that's how they think they can build the ratings back up.
What about the QAnon conspiracy theory adherents? People who leaned heavily into that, they thought some big action was going to happen yesterday. Trump, of course, did not emerge at noon to arrest Joe Biden or Kamala Harris. And what's going to happen to those people? Do they just find their own internet channels, or do they go back to Fox? What happens with that audience?
I think that we're likely to see a bit of a divide. It does seem like a sizable percentage of QAnon supporters were disheartened when the arrests did not happen as they expected. I think some of them will move away from fringe politics over time. They could go back to Fox. They could just sort of move on with their lives. But I also think there's going to be a rump faction of QAnon that will be increasingly radicalized and dangerous in the months and years to come. I mean, remember, the reason that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are supposed to be rounded up and arrested by Donald Trump, according to the QAnon theory, is that they're involved in a globalist, child sex trafficking and ring. You know, that is, you know, secretly controlling most of world affairs. And so that, you know, now those people who believe that no longer think that Donald Trump is going to protect them. And I think we could see some more violence the way we saw at the Capitol earlier this month.
Oh, wow. Well, we also saw a pretty normal press briefing yesterday with the new press secretary, Jen Psaki. So is it going to be increasingly like a split screen of that part of the media and then what we've just been talking about? Or is there any way for Fox to move towards the middle?
I think that that's Fox's decision. And they've made, given every indication in the years past and in the months since the election, they don't want to do that. In many ways, I think that it's partly a demand problem. This is what the Trump base wants. They want to live in this alternate reality. If Fox doesn't give them enough of it, they're going to go to OAN or Newsmax because they will.
Matt Gaetz from Media Matters, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, how a young director came to make a movie about the largest retirement community in the world.
When I got to the community, I lived in an Airbnb in a room with these two retired rodeo clowns who showed me the whole world.
The director of Some Kind of Heaven is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The world's largest retirement community is in Central Florida. It's called The Villages, also known as Disney World for retirees.
It's a little slice of paradise.
Sunshine and golf galore.
Where neighbors stroll the old town.
Men and women from across the country retire to The Villages so they can enjoy its pools, its nightclubs, karate classes, nail salons, restaurants. Non-stop fun. Some 130,000 seniors live there. And as a conservative community, it wields some serious political power in an important swing state. Well, now a new documentary is taking viewers inside the seemingly utopian community to see that it is not all that it seems. The documentary is called Some Kind of Heaven, and its 24-year-old director, Lance Oppenheim, joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So how did you get in to The Villages as someone who is, well, a lot younger than the people who live there? How did you get in there to meet your subjects and make your film?
Well, it's funny. It's not impossible. I think there's a perception of The Villages as if it's like a Fort Knox of a certain kind, because it is an age-segregated community. And as with most age-segregated communities, most of them have gates. But what I quickly learned in The Villages, it's so large. It's spanning three counties. It's larger in square mileage than the size of Manhattan, that they've made a lot of really interesting kind of concessions to the local government. So it's zoned in a very different way. The gates, as one person says in the film, it's a community with gates is what they say, meaning mm-hmm. that anyone can kind of just press a button and the gates open up.
Yeah.
They're symbolically gated, this illusion of security that exists there. And like many things in the villages that I would kind of come to find, there's the facade of the place as this cheery Pleasantville utopian world, which it is for many people. Obviously, there are some folks who don't fit into that kind of marketing brochure advertisement of what the place looks like.
Right. I mean, it is a pretty homogeneous place. It is overwhelmingly Republican. It's overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly heterosexual.
Yes.
But you managed to find three people who didn't fit in, really. And is that what you wanted to do, was to find the people who weren't jibing with this to kind of illustrate a larger point?
I think so. I mean, I started making this film at the end of 2018, and we worked on the film off and on we were going back and forth and living inside of the community for about 18 months. I was fascinated that in a world where everyone is having seemingly the time of their life, and in a lot of ways, I was too having the time of my life. I was about to graduate from college. I think I also kind of had a Peter Pan syndrome of my own kind. I really didn't want to graduate. And there was this thing that happened where I kind of sympathized with a lot of people who lived there, where they all, the villages is this place designed to simulate the 1950s, the 1960s, these like nostalgic images and vision of America that you probably would find in like the Ronald Reagan Morning in America commercial, maybe mm-hmm. in America that never quite existed. So to me, there was something that had happened where I just, after spending a lot of time without a camera in the community, and when I got to the community, I lived in an Airbnb in a room with these two retired rodeo clowns who showed me the whole world and showed me all the clubs. And I just kind of honestly got stressed. I was stressed out that, this idea of you have to have fun, this kind of mandatory fun that everyone was having. And when I started meeting people who weren't fitting into that, I thought there was something interesting there. And I was interested in just finding and exploring this kind of existential condition of yeah. what happens when you get to that place and, the fantasy turns into a nightmare.
It's especially poignant because this is the twilight of these people's lives, right? And so if they're not going to have fun now, when are they going to have fun? When are they going to kind of live out their fantasy? Mm-hmm. And that was especially true or especially poignant with one of your subjects, Barbara. She's from Massachusetts. She moved there with her husband, who then died. So then she was left there alone, and she didn't really have the money to move back to Massachusetts. And she really didn't seem happy there. And I just want to play a clip from your movie where she's met a guy. He is a golf cart salesman. There are a lot of golf carts in the villages. And he's temperamentally seems the exact opposite of her. He's very jovial. He's a partying kind of guy. He loves margaritas. And here she is talking with her hairstylist about him.
I mean, he talked a lot about margaritas.
He likes to drink.
Well, I think it's because he belongs to the Parrot Head Club. I think he's a big member of the Parrot Head Club, Jimmy Buffett. Uh-huh. And I guess he sounds like he's one of the ones in charge of it all the fun times.
So she is attracted to him, it seems, and she seems to come out of her shell a little bit when she's with him. Tell us a little bit more about Barbara.
Barbara is a spectacular individual. And, I think she was essentially a prisoner in some ways of the fantasy. She didn't want to be there. The only reason why she had moved was because of her late husband, who really had this whole idea of how the happily ever after would kind of work out for them. And as soon as they moved in, he got sick and he passed away. But she's also someone who's just got I think in my mind, one of the most expressive faces and mm-hmm. biggest hearts.
Well, she does really exemplify that idea of loneliness in the middle of a crowd. Like you see her dancing alone. Everyone's having fun. She's trying gamely to have fun in the prescribed manner and just can't. And for some reason, she's blocked. And it's so sad to me that she can't enjoy, again, the final leg of her life. She just seems so incredibly sad. And also, it just seemed so interesting that there's only really one way to be in the villages. Like, there are very narrow ideas of what's fun and socially acceptable.
it's true. And I think it's an interesting, I think the way that the police is organized, I do think there's this interesting idea of stressing the importance of community, which I think is a pretty universal one that we could, you know, that everyone I'm sure has their own versions of community and how that manifests in their own lives. But this idea of joining a club, and I think, you know, in the movie, what we try to do is we try to sort of, to me, it looked like, you know, the synchronized golf carts, or you have the synchronized swimmers, you have all mm-hmm. these people that are moving in sync with each other, dressing the same way, talking the same way. The nomenclature of the place is all very homogenous, as you were saying. So to me, I saw this kind of as like almost a Busby Berkeley musical or something, where you could, mm-hmm. you know, how can our camera capture the rhythms and the routines and show, you know, more or less the prevailing social attitude about how to spend your time. And I think it's a lot of people, hopefully when they see the film, can really sympathize with, you know, what Barbara is going through, because I was stressed out by that. I feel like even in high school, when college, when there was anything that was closely sort of that resembles what they're building in the villages, this idea of a club system and tiered, and this is how you meet your friends, and this is how you, you know, you should be talking this way, you should be doing that. I've always struggled with those things in my life, and I could only just deeply empathize with everyone who was going through it again.
Well, someone who really exemplifies what you're talking about, who's really trying to buck this very narrow idea of acceptable behavior, is Reggie, who is experimenting with drugs and transcendental thought. He does Tai Chi, and he is very upsetting to his wife. She likes it there. And I just want to play another clip from your movie where Anne, his wife, has been decorating the house to celebrate their wedding anniversary. They've been married for, I guess, 47 years. And here she is putting up old cards from throughout their marriage, and then Reggie walks in.
Oh, gee. What's wrong?
Tell me.
What?
You don't know.
Worried about you.
Well, if you're worried, I'm not going anywhere. I thought you knew what was going on. I died. Like I told you, I'm reincarnated. I'm in heaven. I'm God. I'm not kidding you. I died in the car wreck. I told him that last night. Everything. And I've been saying to everybody all the time, if you don't believe me, just test me.
Okay. Happy anniversary.
So Anne is just crestfallen. What's going on with Reggie there?
That beats me, honestly. That was a wild moment. Anne has a whole ritual. She has different cards, greeting cards that she's written Reggie on different anniversaries. She puts them up. You know, we were filming it, and then suddenly Reggie bursts in out of nowhere. I think he had just come off from a golf course. I think he had taken mushrooms or something, and he was talking about these visions of how he had died. He had been reincarnated. That heaven is a place on earth, and that they're living in it right now. And we met Reggie when I think he was probably a little bit more lucid and stable. And then, you know, we had left, and then we came back, and then it seemed like things were going, you know, in a worse direction. But him and, you know, Anne had been together for a long time, and this was this kind of attitude, this behavior, it only manifested and became much more obvious when they got to the villages. And I think this kind of goes back to this idea, you know, when you go to the villages, where you're from, you know, what you did in your life, how old you are, a lot of those questions of what you did before coming to the villages are not important anymore. All that really matters is who you are now, and how, you know, what activities and what hobbies you take up. And for Anne, that's pickleball. She's kind of fits the profile of a more typical villager, and she's very intense about what she does. And Reggie, on the other hand, he doesn't fit into a lot of the things and doesn't really like the whole kind of constructed artificial nature of the place. I think a lot of it began to become much more horrifying to Anne when it seemed like there was something quite wrong, actually, with Reggie. And this wasn't just a funny thing that she could kind of just dismiss. And I think in a similar way for us, you know, we were there with Anne when a lot of those moments started to happen. And I think it was a very traumatizing, in some ways, an experience for all of us to go through. And thankfully, things are much more stable now. And I think actually in the course of making the film, I think quite a lot was worked out in their relationship. And again, another kind of example of just like the startling vulnerability and honesty and boldness and braveness that Anne exhibits in the film is just allowing us to go with her to those places, allowing us to follow her to marriage therapy as they work out their relationship.
Right. It really does raise questions of what it means to age and age gracefully and age in a way that is meaningful and what the purpose of life is. If Anne and Reggie aren't together really in a meaningful way, then what is their marriage? Why are they together? And where do you find meaning? And I think Anne is trying to say to Reggie, you find meaning in caring for the people closest to you and loving the people closest to you. Whereas Reggie is looking for something else, I guess. He's looking for it in other ways of thinking and other philosophy and outside the marriage. And I guess it's interesting to see both of them kind of grapple with that and try to come to terms with that, because it's something we struggle with throughout life, right? What what are we here for? And you would hope that by the time you're their age, you would have figured it out, but I guess not.
I mean, I think this is I think you're totally right. I mean, I think some people may find that to be a depressing idea, that you may get to that chapter in your, and obviously growing old is a gift that not everyone gets to experience. And I think once you do get there, you sure hope that most of the things that you're dealing with currently are somehow in the rearview mirror of your life. And I think these stories go to show that isn't necessarily the case all the time. And I think my perspective on it, at least, is that I think that's actually kind of hopeful in a way, that it's the experience of being alive, that nothing is ever figured out really. And that life is always a battle, and it's your perspective and the way you handle things and the things you root for and fight for that really shape it.
I'm wondering, cause you're 24 years old, so you're getting a lot of these life lessons early by talking to these people and filming them and being immersed in their lives. If this has, I don't know, given you some kind of insight into how to age or how to grow up, how to live your life.
That was something in my mind that I feel like I think about quite a lot now. And I take solace in the fact that anytime I'm struggling on something, or if something is really bothering me, that it's okay if it doesn't work out, because most things in life probably won't. And you just need to find a way to make sense of it and make light of it and have fun while you're still, while you're still on this planet.
Yeah, and drink a few margaritas while you're at it.
Yeah.
Well, Lance, thank you so much. I loved your documentary. It's really interesting to watch and also fun. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm kind of painting it as this really sad picture of being old, but it's also a fun watch because it's so quirky. So
thank you. No, thank you. Thank you so much. It means so much coming from you. And I'm just such a fan of the show. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's Lance Oppenheim. He's director of the new documentary, Some Kind of Heaven. It's about the Villages retirement community in Central Florida. And you can stream the movie now on video on demand. Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here to tell you how to make a simple, satisfying dish. This might be the meaning of life. Mushroom soup. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
That means it's time for our weekly food segment with Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food, and also soup connoisseur, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Soup. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I have made, oh my goodness, vats, endless vats of soup in my career as a chef restaurateur. Yes.
Right. So your former restaurant, Angeli, was known for soup.
Yeah, we were known for our soups.
Right. But they're light, like not heavy, chunky soups, right? But light, brothy soups.
Yeah, they're light. I mean, there was, we did very few pureed soups. We did do some. But there was always something to chew on. But all of our soups were made with water, not broth, as the liquid. So all the soups sort of let what the ingredients were speak for themselves. And they were light and also a side benefit, vegan, although in those days, no one cared really too much.
So you used water and not vegetable, chicken, or beef stock.
Right. I mean, you can always do that if you want something that's more complex, has a more savory, a deeper flavor. But if you just want something that's lighter and basically just speaks of whatever it is, in this case, we're going to talk about a mushroom soup that I make, then water is definitely the way to go.
All right. Well, let's talk about this mushroom soup. What kind of mushrooms do you use?
So for this particular soup, I recommend using crimini's. And the thing I love about this soup, I have to say, is I think I first developed this recipe for a cooking class where people wanted to learn how to use prepackaged Trader Joe ingredients, which is kind of hilarious.
And but useful, really useful.
So useful. So so you can do that, or you can chop everything yourself. So the soup is based on crimini mushrooms, which are basically exactly the same as portobello, but smaller. And a good copious amount of mirepoix. And mirepoix is, of course, the magic triad of aromatics made up of onion, celery, and carrots diced. With which you begin to build your soup.
So you're making your vegetable broth. You're not as you're making it.
Exactly. All of these soups, all of our soups that were part of the Angeli repertoire, the broth was basically built as you simmered the ingredients in the water.
When you make or cook the mirepoix, which you can get at Trader Joe's already cut up, so that's helpful.
Yes.
When you're doing that, are you sautéing it in butter, in olive oil? What are you doing?
Well, you know, everything I do is basically Italian-based from the restaurant, so olive oil. And a nice amount of olive oil, too. You know, I'm not talking about deep-frying the vegetables, but none of this one teaspoon or two teaspoons. Whatever pan you're using, you want to add enough oil to film the bottom of the pan. And then sometimes in a soup that's light like this one is, if I have the flavor I want, but the soup needs a little body after all the vegetables are cooked, I will sometimes add another, let's say, quarter cup of oil to add texture and mouthfeel as well as flavor to the soup. So you have to be careful that you're using a good oil.
Okay. So you saute the mirepoix in the olive oil and then you add the mushrooms?
Yeah, you saute the mirepoix. In this particular recipe, the carrots, onion, and celery are joined by garlic, bay leaves, and a little bit of rosemary, not a branch. Not even a whole sprig, if it's a big sprig that you get from a store, maybe 2 inches. That's plenty, just enough to give you a little hint of that flavor. Mm. And once the vegetables soften, which will happen quicker if you salt them, and then I tend to be very impatient, so I salt them and I also put a lid on, and it helps them wilt faster. Then you add your mushrooms, which you stir around so they can, they're so porous, mushrooms, they're just marvelous for that reason. And by throwing them into the mirepoix before you add the liquid, then they absorb all that fantastic flavor.
Mm, yum. And then you put the water in and voila, you have soup.
Then you put the water in, you're adding a little bit of tomato sauce. I love to add parsley to this because it's a very clear broth and the parsley just makes it pretty. A bit of salt and pepper, and then you let it simmer until all the flavors come together.
How long does that take?
I'd say maybe 30 minutes, 40 tops.
And then you have soup.
And then you have soup, but not only soup.
That's
the greatest thing about this soup is that it really is a multitasker. You can make it a soup, and then after you drink the soup, if you have leftover soup but not so much broth, then you can use it as a topping for bruschetta. You can add a little Parmesan cheese and maybe a pat of butter, turn it into a pasta sauce. One of my favorite things to do with this soup is to use it as a base for beef stroganoff.
Mm. That all sounds really delicious. And you can use any mushrooms, right? You don't just have to use creminis?
Yes, any mushrooms at all.
That sounds so easy and doable. I think anyone listening to this could do this.
It really is so, it's so easy. And also what it does is it gets you in the rhythm of doing soups in this style. And so as the seasons roll on, you can just change the main ingredient. So instead of mushrooms, maybe in a month's time, it becomes peas and leeks. Mm. It's endlessly tinkerable. And if you want to use any of these soup ideas for something else like a pasta sauce or a base for risotto, all you have to do is just cut down on the amount of liquid.
Oh, you make it sound so simple.
It is simple.
I mean, cooking in general, you make it sound simple. And I know it's not, because not everyone is a good cook.
But the only way you get to be a good cook is by doing it over and over and over again.
True.
Not everything I make is fabulous. I do have a trash can.
Okay. I don't want to know what's in your trash can. But thank you.
You're welcome.
That's Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. And that's it for us today. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.